Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грегор О'Лиар.
I'm Greg O'Lear. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Nina Burley is here. She talks about this great piece that she wrote for Airmail Weekly called Sons of Anarchy about the plotters who tried to kidnap and intended to kidnap the governor of Michigan. They called themselves the Wolverine Watchmen because they're so cool. She did a great deep dive. This is a fantastic piece. I encourage you to go read it. But we talk about that and both in detail and what they did and also the larger implications of what it means and how it was sort of a prologue for January 6th. Then we talk about Ghislaine Maxwell, Jeffrey Epstein, and the trial that's happening. We recorded this before the trial started, but the build-up to the trial, because Nina is an executive producer on one of the documentaries about Ghislaine, which is called Epstein's Shadow, Ghislaine Maxwell. So we talk about that. And then we talk about COVID and the COVID response. And she's, you know, she last time she was on the show, she talked about the coronavirus, the response, and all kinds of things related to that, because she wrote a book called Virus about that, which I also encourage you to read. Really good book and really good kind of in the moment historical document for what actually happened. Nina has been following the commission that's going into the COVID response stuff. They don't get as much press as the January 6th committee for good reason, but they're doing great work. And she talks a little bit about that at the end of the interview. So, yeah, this is a good one. You're going to want to listen to the whole thing, top to bottom. Not that you would ever think of doing anything otherwise. Before we get started with Nina, I want to talk just a minute about this whole debate, basically, that's going on Twitter, which I understand Twitter is not real life. But there's a debate going on Twitter about Merrick Garland and critiques of Merrick Garland. And is it okay to critique the job that Merrick Garland is doing as Attorney General? Because, you know, there is a narrative out there that's saying, oh, they're not doing anything, they're not doing anything, they're not doing anything. And then there's another narrative out there that says, oh, no, they're doing everything, they're working in secret, they're getting everything airtight, they're dotting the I's, crossing the T's, and all that sort of stuff. And I think, you know, first of all, it's okay to be critical of Merrick Garland or any member of the government. That's part of the, you know, that's part of the perquisites for living in a functional democracy. We're allowed to critique our politicians and our leaders, right? That's what separates us from Russia and like Belarus. Hey, we're even allowed to say FJB on a fucking parade float if we want, because this is America and we're allowed to express ourselves. Even if the words that we use and our political beliefs are trash, we're still allowed to say them, right? That's one of the things that makes this country great. So it's okay to criticize the Department of Justice, the State Department, Biden, anybody that you want to criticize. That's part of our First Amendment rights as Americans. And please exercise them, okay? Me being critical on Twitter or not of Merrick Garland is probably not going to move the needle much, you know, honestly. Although I do think that someone in that office is a little bit in tune to what goes on in the media and how he is portrayed in the media, and that our voices, when joined in some sort of very specific way, do work. Specifically with what LB, Lincoln's Bible, and I have been saying for a long time now, which is speak to us, please. Let us know what's happening. And again, it is possible for the Attorney General of the United States to speak to the American people better than he's been doing without jeopardizing ongoing investigations, okay? It's possible. FDR had fireside chats throughout World War II. He didn't not do them because of fear of screwing up the troop movements or something like that. Part of this job is winning the narrative war, okay? Garland may well be doing great things behind the scenes. In fact, every indication that I've seen is yes, they are investigating J6. Yes, they are arresting people. Yes, they're doing this. Yes, they're doing that. Great. But there's a vacuum, okay? There is a vacuum in the discourse. And into that vacuum, all this disinformation is fire hosed, right? So it is vital for our side to win this war, the information war, the narrative war, right? It is vital and essential that we are constantly churning out the right narrative. And by the right narrative, I mean the correct one, the one that's accurate and true. So, you know, we need to know these things. We need to know what's going on in a generalized way. That's it. So I understand people being critical of Merrick Garland. I'm going to continue to be critical of him until we get indictments. I don't understand why he hasn't formed special counsels to investigate J6 and form a special counsel to investigate the pandemic stuff, right? Two different horrible things that Trump did that should be investigated. This commission that the House is doing, and God bless them for doing it. God bless them for doing it. Pelosi and Liz Cheney and the rest for having this commission. That is the legislature. Their job is not to execute the law, right? That's not their job. It's the executive branch that's supposed to do that. So maybe like the DOJ should, I don't know, do that. And I get it. They're doing it in secret and blah, blah, blah. But I just feel like the message that would be sent by making a special counsel for that is all we need. If he did that, everyone would shut up because we would know that he was on it. Now it's just this mystery. And I think that's what's really at the heart of this. People are fed up with it. Right? They're fed up with not knowing what is going on. We're back to like Mueller, like, oh, Mueller's going to do this. Mueller's going to do that. Mueller did a lot of things. Mueller indicted a lot of these guys. Paul Manafort went to jail. Michael Cohen went to jail. Mike Flynn and Roger Stone were supposed to go to jail. George Papadopoulos went to jail because of Mueller. He didn't do nothing. But the vacuum that existed during the Mueller time was it just wore down any good that came out of that. So that Trump basically ran around saying, no collusion, no collusion. And because Bill Barr cock-blocked the release of the Mueller report, that's the takeaway that most people have, right? We don't want that to happen again because now it's democracy that's on the line. And we have to protect democracy. That's what we have to do. So I don't think it's true that the Attorney General is doing nothing. That is false. That's demonstrably false. The Department of Justice is clearly working to do stuff. Great. I would like to see them do more. I would like to see more results, i.e. indictments, or, hey, let's make this, let's get a special counsel going for these two things, as I just said. Or let's indict Trump for the stuff that Mueller laid out the blueprint for indictment about in the Mueller report in volume 2 with the obstruction charges. Why aren't we doing that? The Department of Justice not doing that, that also sends a message that they don't fucking care. And maybe they do care and maybe they don't, but the message that it's sent is that they don't. The message that is sent is that the president or the former president is above the law, that we are not equal under the law. And that's not how it's supposed to work here in the United States of America, right? So go ahead and be critical of Merrick Garland. It's fine. But it's also not true that he's not doing anything, okay? We can demand more. We can demand urgency. We can demand better communication. And we can also be happy that things are going the way that they are. We don't have Bill fucking Barr in there. We can have those two thoughts simultaneously. It's possible to do that. It's not an all or nothing thing here with this guy. And my God, the stakes could not be higher. We need to know for sure that these guys are taking this seriously. And so far, the reason that there is a debate at all is that we're not sure. That's why there's a debate. So if Merrick Garland and the DOJ wants to stop this arguing on Twitter and elsewhere, what they need to do is give us signs and indications that they're taking this as seriously as we are. And the way to do that is A, indictments, B, set up the special counsels, and C, better communication. That's it. That's all we want. It's not a lot to ask for. And it's not, I'm not being a bad citizen by demanding better communication from my politicians and my leaders. And neither are you. So that's my 2 cents. It's actually, it's more than 2 cents. It's probably 75 cents based on how long I've been prattling on here. I'm going to stop now. We're going to be right back with Nina Burley. Hi, I'm Dr. Oz, and I'm running for Senate in the great state of Pennsylvania. I got confused because I don't actually live in Pennsylvania. I'm besties with Recep Erdogan, the authoritarian leader of Turkey. You know, the strongman who talked to Trump on the phone all the time, the guy Mike Flynn was working for, the fascist who sent his jackbooted thugs to beat up protesters here in Washington. Yeah, that's my homie. During the pandemic, I suggested that opening schools and losing 3% of our student population to COVID death was a risk worth taking. I still believe that because of these qualifications. Again, I'm totally chill with kids dying and pals with a legit dictator and willing to run for office in a place where I don't live. I'm a natural fit with the Republican Party. But I'm also Oprah's guy, which will hopefully confuse Democrats. Plus, I have the same name as a certain beloved wizard who, like me, turned out to be a giant self-aggrandizing fraud. So if you live in Pennsylvania, and hey, even if you don't, vote Oz in 2022. Pennsylvania needs a conservative who will put America first. The lives of a few million innocent children is a small price to pay for freedom. And now, back to the show. Nina Burley, welcome back to Prevail.
Thank you, Greg Oliar. Good to be here.
We've got a lot to talk about. I want principally to discuss the piece that you just wrote, which is called Sons of Anarchy. You wrote this for Airmail Weekly, and it's about basically the plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer. And it's really a horrifying kind of, the whole thing is horrifying. And it, as you say in the piece, it's sort of a prologue or a foreshadowing of what happens next with the insurrection. I think it's, you know, kind of like Jan Hus and Wycliffe were the forebearers before Martin Luther came along. I think that's what these guys are. So before we started, right before we taped, you said, oh, really, we should get this down. And you talked about the idea of menace and law enforcement. So why don't we start right with that? So tell me again what you were just saying so people know.
Yeah. So the Michigan governor kidnapping plot is just an extreme example, extreme, risible and sinister example of, and risible because it didn't end in bloodshed. Example of a style in American politics or in American political discourse that is becoming the norm in the post-Trump era. Temporarily post-Trump, hopefully permanently. And that is menace as a way to control politics. Menace as a way to control the elected officials or people running for office who were speaking out from the center left or even the center or even from the Republican side, but not agreeing with the Trump Republican fanatics. And by menace, I mean like death threats. And, you know, my story is just a microscope taken to this one particular case. But there have been in the last week articles by Reuters. Reuters went and did a big dive into 9 incidents of death threats that were directed towards elected officials. And by elected, I mean, not, you know, somebody is obscure as, you know, a superintendent of school or a vote, you know, somebody who's in charge of voting machines in a small county. And the examples that the Reuters investigative team pulled up are all cases in which the police haven't done a thing, where in people have, you know, in Arizona and in Utah and out west and in the Midwest have made open threats to elected local officials, to the tune of things like, I know where you live. I know where your children go to school. You better be careful. I know where you sleep. You know, these types of, I'm going to see you hang. I'm going to see you hanged. These types of threats that are not being reacted to by law enforcement. And in the cases that the Reuters team looked at, the reason, I guess, was that the law enforcement response was, well, we can't find them, or, you know, we don't have any evidence of this. And the team, the Reuters investigative team, went and found these people with ease, and they were proud of what they had said in public, the death threats that they had delivered in public. You know, similarly, the Times did a piece last week, menace is the new norm in American politics. And, you know, they listed off a bunch of examples, again, that I was not familiar with. These things are not rising up to the level of where we're seeing them on Twitter all the time, or we're seeing them in big coverage on, you know, in the big newspapers or the big websites. But there are things like, you know, in Montana, some guy gets up at a rally for one of the extremists running for Congress and says, well, when are we going to be able to use our guns to shoot Democrats? And, you know, the whole hall roared in approval. And that's just one example. I mean, it's happening all the time, every day, and law enforcement is not doing anything about it. When I was working on this article, I thought to look into whether or not Michigan has a law that says you can't make death threats to public officials, because one of the things these guys did was, before they actually went underground with this plot, they were quite open on social media about how much they hated her, how much they hated the tyrant bitch, and many other names that we won't repeat here. You know, a lot of sexualized fantasies and of harming her. Lots of things were being said, and the FBI was watching this the whole time. They were on these guys, as they've been on them from March of 2020 forward. So they were quite aware of the way they were talking. And the lawyers for these defendants are saying, well, it was just their First Amendment right. They can say these things. It's ugly talk. One of the lawyers I talked to, it's ugly talk. I call it ugly talk, but it's protected by the First Amendment. But actually, it isn't protected by the First Amendment. You can't make threats of bodily harm to people. It's against the law to do that. And, you know, that's why you get restraining orders. You know, you can get law enforcement involved when that happens, but they just aren't jumping in.
I thought it was assault. I thought that assault and battery meant, I thought assault was the threat and battery was the physical act of the threat. But I don't know, I'm not a lawyer, and I might have been remembering it wrong from years ago. But yet there does seem to be this rise of certainly menacing people going to school board meetings lately, dressed up in their bullshit idiot regalia to try to terrorize people. And I think it goes part and parcel with law enforcement, police officers in general, being outfitted by military gear that the military is trying to unload. And then when law enforcement looks at a neighborhood or a community as like they're invading Fallujah or something, rather than them being part of that community, then you have a problem. There's a disconnect, and the capacity and the chance of violence is so much greater. And law enforcement is a big, I think, through line in your story also, because, and we'll get to it, when the people went to the state house in Michigan with their guns, they were let in and the cops didn't do anything about it. And everybody was like, what the actual F is going on here? How can that happen? And you say in the story, well, you know, it can happen because it's legal to bring a gun into the state house. It's not legal to bring a sign that says something bad, which strikes me as just preposterous. I mean, Second Amendment is okay, but not the first.
That's true in 20 states, at least 20 states, Texas for sure. 20 states allow people to come into the state capitol building with weapons, loaded weapons, and some are allowing concealed weapons to be brought in. And yet, if you walk in there with a sign stating your opinion, you can be arrested and are arrested. So, but what you just said about the law enforcement, you know, the militarized suits that they wear and so on, you're getting at it, but it's, there's a little bit more to it that what's going on here is these guys, these militia members in Michigan are members of a, what I would call a subculture of gun love. And they all are, almost all of them had jobs as security guards or at gun ranges. One of them was a safety officer at a gun range. The FBI informant, the guy who ended up wearing the wire and handing over all their encrypted chats to the FBI in real time, was an Iraq war vet who was looking for, he's part of this gun subculture. He's a 2A, pro 2A libertarian, is how he describes himself. And he went on Facebook looking for guys to train with. Like, he'd been out of the military for a while. He's a wounded veteran. And he was looking for guys to train with. He felt like he was losing his training. So Facebook's algorithm pushed him towards this group. That's how he found them. Facebook's algorithm, recognizing that he was interested in Second Amendment rights, pushed him towards this extreme little corner where this guy had, you know, Joe Morrison had set up this militia after being pulled over, and or actually not even pulled over. The cops saw him sitting on the side of the road in a disabled vehicle, and they found an unregistered weapon in his car. He's a gun lover, and they put him in jail for a night. That enraged him so that he started the Wolverine Watchmen, which is this little club of men who, again, Facebook delivered a lot of their members, and the other members they picked up by going to those state capitol anti-lockdown rallies and pro-2A rallies, and they brought more members in that way. But the gun subculture is the issue here. They are enabled, and they're enabled and protected by these people who are, and by the way, the documents, I looked at hundreds of pages of court documents. I looked at the transcribed encrypted chats. There are people walking around in Michigan, a real estate agent in Lansing, girlfriends of these guys who were really involved all the way down the line. They just weren't in, you know, they're not deemed to be, you know, engaged in the plot the way the others were, but they were at the trainings. You know, the trainings were, I mean, literally it's like something out of, as you said earlier, it's Thomas Pynchon crossed with Carl Hiaasen. Like, it's utter paranoia crossed with these most ridiculous kinds of combinations of things. Like, they're smoking, a lot of them are smoking weed and in their field training exercise, they're getting high, and they're, you know, at the same time practicing shooting their AR-15s at cutouts of cops and the governor. So they're high and they're using these weapons in their backyards. Meanwhile, their women folk are on a field, one field over, practicing knife and axe throwing because they're part of the club too. They're the auxiliary, also smoking weed. So some of them, not all of them. So, you know, this little subculture that, you know, the gun loving subculture is a factor in this, in that a lot of the members came from that background. As you know, as I said, the veteran, the Iraq war veteran Dan, whose name we don't say his last name because he's in hiding now, he was delivered to them by Facebook's algorithm. And after 2 or 3 days of interacting with them, I mean, because they fetishized the military, when they met this guy, they were like, oh my God, we've got, you know, a real veteran here. And many of them had washed out of the military. They had made it through basic training, or they were only in the reserves. So that this guy who had actually been wounded in Iraq was among them, just gave them, you know, no end of thrills and chills. So he was invited in right away, and he was there for 3 days, and he started to realize, whoa, they're talking about shooting cops, and they want to kill people in law enforcement. And that doesn't strike him as patriotic fun with guns. So he goes off, talks to a police officer friend of his in Flint, Michigan. And that police officer called the FBI. And the FBI then called Dan and brought and called him into their offices. And this is in March of 2020. And they said, would you help us? Would you wear a wire? You know, we think these guys are dangerous. And he says, yes, I think they're dangerous too, but I don't know if I want to wear a wire. He's not unlike the informants that the FBI used through the war on terror years when they were really entrapping and rounding up hapless Muslims that they were recruiting. They were sending informants out to recruit and arm people at mosques. Unlike those types of informants who usually are criminals working off a charge, this guy wasn't that. He wasn't a professional informant. He wasn't getting paid to do it. And he was very reluctant to do it. He was worried about his child, as you would be if you're going to go in there and wear a wire. And in fact, they were the Wolverine Watchmen were so paranoid about the feds after the first couple of months when they realized, you know, this is real. We're really going to go get the governor. They started taking themselves off social media and moving from encrypted platform to encrypted platform, trying to get away from any kind of surveillance, unwittingly inviting in and having amongst them this their hero who turned out to be wearing the wire the whole time.
What I found interesting about this cast of characters, because it starts off, as you said, by this guy, Morrison, who is pulled over, spends the night in jail, and he's just enraged. And there's pictures of these dudes on the website, which are worth looking at, because, again, risible is the name. I mean, these guys are, they're losers by any metric available, right? And it's interesting to me that the only person in that entire group that actually was in the military is the one that was like, whoa, fuck this noise. I can't do this. I'm going to have to turn these guys in. Who did his, you know, Frank, who did his job, and good on him. Good on you, Dan, if you're listening. But yeah, the rest of these guys are just a bunch of jokers. And I think the name of the outfit, the Wolverine Watchmen. I mean, that's two superhero things like mashed together, right? You have Wolverine,
right,
from the X-Men, and then you have the Watchmen, you know, from the Watchmen, and they've mashed this, right, together. And it seems to me these guys are all, they're like children. They're like boys that never quite grew up, or they never got to a certain level of maturity. And the only difference now is that because they're grownups and they have these rights, they can go and get guns and shoot guns and do this and that. But they're still, they're boys. They don't have any kind of, you know, maturity that allows them to be functional members of society. Because a lot of them, as you said, they couldn't get through basic training. They, you know, some of them couldn't hold jobs very well. One guy's living in the guy that they think is this great genius is living in a basement of like a vacuum store, which is like a scene, yeah, from Breaking Bad, right? It's
yeah, I descended into the lair. Yeah, it was that was quite a trip. I mean, that the voyage into that part of Michigan was, you know, I grew up a few counties over, like spent my childhood actually in the woods out there in a few counties over from where these guys were doing their basic training or their field training exercises, they called it. And I recognize the type. Like, I recognize that there are people who would love and protect baby squirrels and yet also love guns and you know, really want to shoot a cop. Like, I can understand that, you know, I've met that type, not necessarily that want to shoot a cop, but that love guns, but also love to protect a baby squirrel that they found, as Grandpa Pete Musico, one of the older guys of the group, had in his bedroom next to his dummy grenade and his weapons, the little baby squirrels that he had rescued from a fallen tree.
But that's a child thing too, you know, right?
It is a child thing, but it's also, you know, like it's a country boy thing. And you know, I don't think that that's that unusual. I mean, you're calling it a maturity thing. I would call it more of a kind of a hedonistic, consumerist attitude towards freedom. I mean, they were obsessed with freedom. They were obsessed with liberty, 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 liberty. You see it all over their memes and their Their freedom was being taken away. And what freedoms are they talking about? You know, okay, so first of all, obviously it's the guns. Don't you dare take my guns away. Don't take my guns away. And some of them had, criminal records. So they really were in danger of getting them taken away if the laws were tightened on that issue, right? So they were worried about the guns. But it's not just that. They're worried about, you know, being pulled over because they hadn't paid their auto insurance, or, you know, how dare a cop pull me over because I, you know, made a right turn without putting my signal on. You know, the freedoms are personal freedoms, the freedom to go to the gym, the freedom to carry your gun into a pizza place and buy a pizza. You know, these are like individual, this sense of restriction, I guess, is what I think really links them together. This real simmering anger about other types of restrictions that then were provoked to the boiling point by the lockdown, because the lockdown was, of course, the other reason that they're so obsessed with freedom and they fetishize it is that they live in these misinformation silos, or these right wing, you know, news silos, where they've been taught, warned for years that the left is setting up a totalitarian dictatorship imminently. Your rights are about to be taken away. And now, of course, that talk has bled straight into Fox News. So you've got people like Tucker Carlson saying it and Laura Ingraham saying it. So they had this obsession with freedom. And the lockdown on March 17th, or when Whitmer said everybody's got to stay home. Well, first he said no more gyms, no more restaurants, and then it was stay home for a while. And, you know, the COVID was surging. They regarded that as the sign that they had been warned about, that they were going to be taken off straight off to FEMA camps and had their guns taken away, because they've been warned, because the right, the extreme right, has been feeding this notion, this paranoia, into the stream of information that these guys were accessing. So they are a direct result of this type of misinformation, disinformation, propaganda campaign, in addition to the fact that, you know, the state of Michigan has these very lax gun laws, and then the pandemic, which, you know, everybody experienced it differently. These guys experienced the lockdown as, oh my God, China, Governor Whitmer is like Xi, you know, it's China, and we're going to be, you know, we're going to be locked up imminently, and our guns are going to be taken away. So there was real panic. You can see the real panic in their conversations. They lived in this bubble. They communicate with each other on these issues, and they decided that, you know, she was the tyrant bitch. I don't think that yes, it's immaturity, but that's not very specific to them. I think there are a lot of men in America who agree with them, who have the same sentiments. You know, the thing about Michigan is there's a lot of backcountry where you can play army in the woods. We used to play army in the woods when we were kids. You know, ex-FBI agent that I talked to about this said, yeah, they're like kids who are playing army.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here. And I think immaturity meaning, you know, just boys need their toys. But I think there's also, there's a lot there about loss of power. I think loss of personal power and loss of power, you know, writ large in many different ways, if you're these guys. And again, I don't want to overgeneralize. Each person that participates in something like this is an individual that has his own reasons for doing so, or her, because I want to talk about the women in a minute too. But I think, you know, part of it is loss of power. They're afraid that somebody's going to come take their gun. Like, what kind of force would be powerful enough to go through the entire country and take everyone's guns away? Like, what do they, the logistics of that are impossible. It's never going to happen. But they feel like if they don't have those guns, that's really all they have that's preventing them from, you know, I guess, awakening to their lives, or, you know, being better people. I don't know. maybe going to the military and being able to get through it. I don't know, but there's also
The NRA has been feeding them that notion forever. Yeah. You know, that's it's mainstreamed now they're coming to get your guns. They're coming to get your guns. And that's why after Obama got elected, you know, the loss of power issue, there was a huge surge in gun buying, as mm-hmm. we know, because yeah. first of all, they were warned that here's this black president, he's going to take your guns away, and then brown people are going to come get your stuff. And that notion provoked another militia at the same time, right after Obama got elected in Michigan, they were plotting to kill cops, and they got they got caught before they did anything. But they thought that, like, communists, there were some Russian tanks at a Northern Michigan army base, and they thought those Russian tanks were a sign that, you know, the Russians were on their way into Michigan. Stuff like that, you know, just misinformation, credulity, and a exacerbated by the enormous number of fake information sites that are really set up to by the Republicans or their enablers in the donor class to provoke these emotions that go along with seeing somebody who isn't supposed to be in power, in their view, in power. So in the state of Michigan, you had three women, you still do, three women at the top of the government, like a Nordic country.
I was going to say that too.
It's Whitmer and it's Nessel and the Secretary of State, whose name I'm blanking on. So three women at the very tippy top of the government. And these guys can't stand it. It was like seeing the brown man be in the White House. That just drove people nuts. We didn't understand that. You know, those of us who don't feel that way thought it was great or thought it was just fine and, you know, thought Obama did an okay job. But, you know, that whole time people were seething because there was this image of somebody who wasn't supposed to be in power. So in the state of Michigan, part of the problem there was these guys responding to the female in the role of governor, the female face of the lockdown, the tyrant bitch. And, you know, they just couldn't stand it. And Attorney General Nessel told me that the state of Michigan, you know, all of the women in elected office there, and this was months ago, so I'm sure it's even worse now. The women have, they routinely, judges too, female judges, they routinely field death threats and really nasty menace. And this has been going on for a year or more than a year, you know, and they are, because she's the attorney general, their office handles this. And she herself, the attorney general, was subject to so many threats, serious threats during the lockdown that she thought about resigning, because when she was in lockdown, like everyone else, you know, these state officials are in their own houses. And how many cops can be parked outside of your house night and day when you have children in your house and you're getting threatened by people like this who are going to come and, you know, saying they're going to come and kill you, execute you for treason, so on. She literally thought about quitting her job. This is the attorney general of the state of Michigan. And, you know, it doesn't rise to the level of a kidnapping plot, but it was exactly the same motive. It's responding to a female. They didn't go after male governors. Some of them talked about it because they brought in, at the end, they were bringing in people from out of state. They kind of coalesced with other right-wing extremist groups or boogaloo dudes. And they, those out-of-staters, they made a decision like, well, should we do Ralph Northam? Because they hated, you know, Virginia governor. So, well, let's do him. No, let's just do Whitmer. You know, that's who they focused on. And it had a lot to do with women, power, and how upsetting that is to some people.
Again, it comes back to loss of power. That's another way, writ large, the power, they perceive power as being lost. It's not only that they're not in power and that the government in some shadowy way is going to come take their guns. It's not even a dude, you know, it's a woman in power. My God, how can we have that? You know, how can something like that happen? And it speaks to something that's happening now culturally. I mean, men are, Josh Hawley, the senator, talked about it, Nina, the other day. I mean, you know, men are under assault.
Oh, I missed that.
Said.
What did he say?
He wants to make masculinity. He said a lot of cuckoo things. He wants to make masculinity a big topic. Josh Hawley does. Uberman, you know, Josh Hawley. Because when you think
Little
macho
man,
you think first Josh Hawley, then The Rock, and then maybe somebody else, right? But one of the factoids that he was trotting out in the speech of his is that the you know, fewer men are going to college now than were before. You know, there's a more percentage of women, and soon it's going to be a lot more. So that, you know, down the line, you know, there's almost this sense of obsolescence. I think if you're these guys, you can feel this sense of obsolescence, which, you know, Samuel Johnson said in what, 1620 or whatever it was, nature has given women so much power that the law cannot afford to give them any more. So he knew what was up.
That's a great quote.
You know, well, it isn't it? Because, you know, once the takeover happens, mm-hmm. we men are done. We all know this. You know, even these guys in the Michigan woods know that, that it's over. So, yeah. But no, I'm joking.
Yeah, but that's so far in. That's so far in the future, Greg.
Alas, yes. But there is, I think, with guys like this sense of desperation, because a lot of their identities are wrapped up in that they're masculine guys. Even the way that you described how those camps functioned, they were separated by gender. You had the women in one, you know, on one field and the men in the other field, and the men had the guns and the women had the knives. You know, I guess, do they have different exactly. strains of weed? I don't know. But there was, you know, there's a separation there along the sort of traditional gender role lines that, you know, culturally.
As God intended, Greg. As God intended. The women also were nurses. They were nurses. Some of them were actually nurses. Like right. they actually work in hospitals. They were, when the men got serious about the kidnapping plot, they stopped inviting women. They stopped inviting wives and girlfriends. Mm-hmm. That was no longer a part of their deal. And the wives and girlfriends, the wife of the founder of the Watchmen, at their last meeting said, since it's likely that you all will get injured in this effort, we women should start studying nursing and how to treat gunshot wounds. And that person is still free, never charged. So one of the women, Adam Fox's girlfriend, also never charged, walking free in the state of Michigan, is on tape twice saying, I really want to know what it feels like to shoot someone in the head.
Well, you know, that's just ugly talk, Nina. That's all that is. It's just ugly talk. It sounds like they were enabling them and kind of, you know, urging them forward in a way, and not a very nice way.
Of course.
One more thing while we're on this topic, specifically the plot to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer. You know, she's a woman. She's also an attractive woman. And I think that matters to some degree. I think with these guys, it matters. We have a tendency in our society, I think, to sexualize, women especially. And the perception is if somebody's very attractive, that they can't also be smart and competent and this and that. And it's something that I think women have to overcome or reconcile with in order to be successful. And she's managed to do that. And that I would guess that on some subconscious level fuels how much they hate her.
Yeah. The looks thing probably is, but they also would hate, you know, they would hate an Angela Merkel too, I think. But they might not have the same.
True.
They might not have the same fantasy of hog tying her and laying her on a table and live streaming it.
Yeah,
you know, mm-hmm.
That's what I'm getting at. I mean, it's just vile.
Yeah,
the whole thing. So fortunately, Dan, our serviceman here, our wounded vet, blew the whistle on these guys, and not only blew the whistle on them, but stayed with them, and was an informant for the FBI the entire time.
Yeah,
and. When they got arrested, he got arrested also to make it look like he was in on it.
Yeah.
And I guess what happened then? He just left? He got witness protection or what happened?
Well, I don't know where he is right now. I mean,
we don't want to.
No, I'm not going to out where he is. I mean, I don't actually.
No, no, no.
I know that from the court records that they gave him a little bit of money, 50 grand total is what he got. And part of it was to make up for the loss because he had to sell his house after this so that he could hide. Mm. And he's in hiding with his family and he's going to have to testify. And, you know, what one other thing that we haven't talked about here is this whole idea of, you know, the defense attorneys have to argue entrapment. They don't have anything else because everything is recorded and there's transcripts of these guys saying what they were going to do, right? In addition to Dan's testimony and his, you know, they've got recordings and they've got transcripts of encrypted chats. So the attorneys in this interim period between the charging, which came about in October of 2020, and then they had some more hearings in early 21, up till now, have been basically pretty silent. But into that void have come journalists, and they talk to the defense attorneys, and the defense attorneys are feeding them, because there are thousands and thousands of hours of recordings, the defense attorneys did not get, you know, the prosecution didn't put all every single word that they recorded into these documents. So some of the defense attorneys, for example, Adam Fox, who's like the leader at the end, was the leader of the whole thing, the guy who lived in the Vac Shack basement. His lawyer spent the summer listening to audio that, you know, because they got it from the government. And it was like looking for a needle in a haystack, but they were looking for examples of Dan not behaving like he was supposed to and behaving more like he was aiding and abetting and pushing them towards the crime. So what happened was that kind of storyline, BuzzFeed did a big piece. They got a lot of documents showing that there were more FBI agents running around the periphery of this group than was commonly known. So they put that into a big story and they advanced this notion of entrapment. And what you have is, and then of course, Glenn Greenwald has picked it up. What you have is people like now Tucker Carlson picking up on this idea of, well, look at the deep state was in there in Michigan and they created the plot. They entrapped these gun-loving patriots and look what they've done. And this is exactly what happened in 1-6. So they're taking the entrapment defense from the Michigan case and applying it into the 1-6, you know, their bullshit theory that the government was, you know, had sent in provocateurs to get them in trouble and break down the doors and beat the cops, right? So in this other way, this is another way that this case is, you know, it's a microcosmic or prologue to the 1-6, because the fantasy of arresting and killing political leaders, the enactment of an assault on a government building, and then this, you know, excuse that, well, the, you know, they were entrapped, they really weren't doing anything wrong, they were just talking ugly talk, is very similar in both cases, and that's something that they're running with. But I don't think, given what I know about this case, that they're going to win. I've been told by FBI agent who worked undercover in cases like this in other states that it's very difficult to win an entrapment case. And you can see that with those Muslim terrorism cases that were brought in New Jersey and places like that in the OOs and the teens, where they just have ridiculously recruited these guys from, again, the mosques and around the mosques, and armed them and had the informant feed them a plot. And in this case, that's not what was going on. You can see from the records that they were talking about, they were obsessed with Gretchen Whitmer's vacation home starting very early on in May, because the Daily Mail, again, here you have the right-wing
media. I was going to say, yeah.
The right-wing media echo chamber. Mm-hmm. The Daily Mail on May 26th posted a story about her vacation home and a dock worker, a Republican or pro-Trump dock worker up there, who had put up a Facebook post saying, you know, Governor Whitmer's husband called and asked me to take his boat out of dry dock this weekend. And that means that she's defying her own stay-at-home orders. And in fact, the stay-at-home orders were no longer enforced by Memorial Day, but that was picked up by the Daily Mail. They put a picture of her vacation home in the story. And that afternoon, the one of the founders of the Wolverine Watchmen posted a real estate listing with the exact coordinates of where she lived or where she vacations. And from then on, they were obsessed with going up there because it looks like a soft target. I mean, it genuinely is a soft target. It's out in the woods, you know, on a lake, on a dark, you know, pine-shrouded upper Michigan lake. And they imagined that it would be easy for them to grab her there, that they would kill the security detail, bust in, decide on the spot whether or not to kill the family members. I mean, literally, they talked about this. And then they would drag her out and either put her on their painted black boat and float her across the little lake to their cars, or take her over to Lake Michigan and put her in a boat without an engine out in the middle of the lake and walk away, leave her out there floating, or take her all the way to Wisconsin and then have a trial in which she was tried for treason and then execute her in Wisconsin. Again, all of it public, you know, live streamed. And they got a ways down the road with surveilling her house. They went up there twice in two cars each time. They, you know, at night, they drove past the house at night several times to see if they could see the lights on the other side of the lake. The other part of their team, they made a map of the lake and the boat ramps. And the second time they went up, they decided, you know, this is a remote cabin, but there is a Michigan State Police headquarters within 20 miles on a highway. So they decided they were going to have to blow up the bridge that connected that highway, major highway, to this little hamlet. And in order to do that, they needed explosives. And that's when the FBI stepped in and offered, they sent an undercover in and said, you know, this guy can sell you the C4 that you need and other gear. And they five of them got in a car and drove to this meeting point in a warehouse in a rundown auto parts factory town that no longer makes auto parts, Ypsilanti, and they got arrested. And then those people in the car who went to buy the explosives were arrested on the spot. And then the other eight were arrested that same night in their homes. And the state charged ones are in, most of them are bailed out in their homes, disarmed. And the federally charged six who really have big, big charges against them they're not bailed out. They're in federal prison. One of the federally charged, the airline mechanic who knew how to make ghost guns, airline mechanic who worked at the airport in Detroit, by the way, with airplanes. He has pled guilty and has agreed to cooperate and testify against his comrades. So they gave him 6 years. And that's very short, given that it's going to be 20 to life for the rest of them. So that guy's lawyer, who I've interviewed, is on the record saying this was a real plot. This wasn't just something that the government came in and fed these guys. And when the trials start, that narrative that has been seized by the defense attorneys and people like Glenn Greenwald, Tucker Carlson, and so on, is not going to hold up, because they are going to show what you can easily see if you read all the documents, that these guys were having these conversations and already were heavily armed. That's the other thing. They were not armed by the government, which is what the FBI was doing with these Muslim entrapment cases. They had armories. I mean, Ty Garbin, the airline mechanic, had a gun safe with, I don't know, 10 semi-automatic weapons in his prefab, very spick and span subdivision, actually. See, the other myth about all this is that these guys are all rabble. You know, you see the pictures and some of them actually do look that way, but others were not. You know, there's a real estate agent in Lansing who's all over these documents, telling them how to evade the feds and so on. He's still a real estate agent in Lansing right now.
This whole thing is really horrifying. And yeah, no, if you're if you're advanced enough in the plot that you're going to go buy explosives to blow up a fucking bridge, that's not, you don't get back from that. You know, this, she's lucky that this didn't come to pass. That they could have,
well,
very easily have happened, and it would have been just,
yes,
horror movie level awful.
If they didn't have Dan in there, how far would they have gone down the path? I mean, the defense attorneys are going to argue that they wouldn't have gotten that far. I don't think the record shows that he was pushing them towards it. They engaged with each other. They engaged with larger groups of people who were more, even more committed than they were eventually to plot this. It is true that the FBI had alerted the governor's security team weeks before they arrested them, that this was something that was going on, and to be out on the lookout for them, because they were driving around her house in the dark, you know, in a very remote part of Michigan.
It's unconscionable that the Daily Mail would print that with her address in it. I mean, Tucker Carlson was recording his stupid fucking show in a remote location in Maine. You could figure out where it was if you went looking, but nobody published it.
Right.
You know, nobody publishes where Brett Kavanaugh's fucking house is in Chevy Chase. You can find it, but it's not published. They don't make it easy for you. It's right. only the right-wing media does shit like that. It's really disgusting. Right. But, you know, that's a disgusting publication run by disgusting people. So
that's right. You know. And, you know, there's a great picture circulating on Twitter of the editor, the Daily Mail editor, with his hands all over Ghislaine Maxwell at some party.
Mm-hmm.
And it's out there today because, of course, she's going on trial very soon. But yeah, that's who they're, that's how they operate. And they are not responsible. Let's just say that. They're not responsible.
No. No, it's disgusting. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with Nina Burley. I've got more questions for you.
Season 2 of Swing Left's How We Win is here. We have an incredible opportunity to fight for our democracy.
We don't agonize, we organize.
And we've got a lot of work to do.
Subscribe right now on Apple and everywhere you get your pods for insight, action, and your reasons for hope. I'm Steve Pearson.
And I'm Mariah Craven.
And this is season 2 of How We Win.
Okay, we're back with Nina Burley. I want to talk about Ghislaine. We started this real quick. Now you're a producer of the documentary, right? What is the documentary called that you're producing?
Epstein's Ghost, Ghislaine Maxwell. And it's streaming on Peacock in the US and Sky News in Europe. It's a 3-part doc and it's been out since May. We may be making a fourth episode because she's going on trial starting December 1st. And the trial is looking like it's going to be pretty interesting because the judge recently refused to redact a lot of the names and acts that they are trying to keep out of the public record. And of course, you know, the redactions and the promise of confidentiality has always been what this woman and these people, you know, Epstein and the rest of them depended upon. The names have been redacted from the documents, but they may now be, we may see more names or more garish acts by Ghislaine Maxwell that have been kept redacted in the documents that have been released so far. It is that's one thing that we're going to look for. And the other thing will probably be that they really drill down hard on Andrew. And that's, you know, of more interest. Personally, I think it's more interest to the British than you know, but they've got Clinton palling around with her. That's in the documents, I think. Certainly in the flight logs. And, you know, what we did with the documentary was, you know, there already was a big documentary on the victims and what, you know, their side of the story was. That was the big Netflix story, doc.
Right.
What we were trying to do was look at the why of this, not the what. We know what they were doing. We know that they were bringing in underage girls and grooming them, literally. I think Epstein was basically just the male body that they were training these 14-year-olds on, get them used to it so that then they could send them off to other men who were more powerful and who they needed to have influence over. And they would have video. They had video cameras in every room and every one of the mansions and the, you know, the island and the ranch out in New Mexico. Everything was recorded. And I think that it was a blackmail factory. I don't, an influence operation of some kind. We have people saying that. We have a lot of evidence pointing to it. But is that ever going to be provable? I don't know if they, that is not the goal of this trial. You know, that's the problem. Like you'll get the woman who was, you know, his social networker and the woman who was procuring these girls. But what you're not going to understand from the trial, I don't think, is why they were doing it. The true scope of it is not about Jeffrey Epstein's carnal desires. He's a block of ice.
Yeah.
There's something else was going on.
That's an interesting theory, actually, and it makes a lot of sense. I mean, clearly these guys are working with intelligence agencies all over the place, and the fact that Ghislaine is where she is and there's so much mystery around what's happening also seems to suggest that, yeah, she's connected to somebody on some level that's protecting her, including the, you know, the royal family.
The royal family, but of course her father, you know, it's the family business. I mean, the father was a triple spy. I mean, he was not only was he a criminal who absconded with hundreds of millions of pension money from the British paper that he owned, but he spent most of his life doing kind of gopher work between the KGB, the Mossad, the CIA. I mean, he was the go-between, and he would bring, and he literally brought to the Soviets American technology that precedes all of the, you know, the NSA stuff that we have now. In the 80s, it was called Promise, and it was like a network where they could track. It was meant to be for law enforcement, where you could track a lot of people and track what they were doing and their crimes and their alleged crimes and their cases. And they gave this technology to the Israelis. The Americans got it to the Israelis, who then got it to the KGB through their connection to the KGB being Mr. Robert Maxwell. And this technology, because it was coming from the CIA and was well known to the CIA that this was going to happen, had a backdoor trapdoor in it, or a backdoor where the government of the United States could actually watch what the KGB was doing with it. And Robert Maxwell was the middleman on that. He was also the middleman heavily involved in the Iran-Contra stuff. He was bagman.
Yeah.
So that's her dad. Her dad could cross borders anytime, anywhere between Soviet Union and Israel and the UK. And he was very useful to a lot of people. And he played his role as a super spy, as one of the books about him says. So she's just daddy's little girl, you know, and he may have introduced her to Epstein. Epstein certainly entered. He was in the UK in the 80s, and he certainly knew Maxwell. He certainly was involved in gun, big, big, big arms deals, scandalously gigantic arms deals between the UK and the Saudis. Epstein was up in that. So, you know, it's just this, I mean, you've talked to people about him. I think you've talked to people about this, but
yeah, sure.
It's, you know, it's, I'm not telling, I don't think I'm telling people a lot what they don't know, but I don't think that that's going to come out during the trial. I think there might be some deal where they maybe get Andrew out of her because for some reason they're obsessed with getting Andrew here, the Justice Department, but they're not really getting, they're not getting to the bottom of why somebody like Leon Black would fork over $150 million to this guy who has absolutely no Wall Street training or skills, other than having been involved in a pyramid scheme that sent his partner to jail for 20 years. He was untouched because he was obviously doing what the FBI needed him to do or telling them things that they needed to know. So I think we'll learn maybe some new names. And I do think that she'll get convicted. I don't think she's going to be free from prison for a long time. I think 10 years or something.
Good.
See what happens.
Yeah. Good. You know, yeah. The Andrew stuff is interesting. I was talking to Arthur Snell, who's a British diplomat, was now he has a podcast and he's at Orbis Intelligence with Chris Steele. And I asked him about Andrew and do you think, you know, are we going to get him here? What's going on with that? And one of the things he said is that it's widely reported. I mean, who knows if it's true, but the Queen prefers Andrew. That's her favorite. And, you know, but Charles does not. Charles thinks that Andrew is kind of an embarrassment. And my God, how could he have done this horrible thing? And, you know, at some point, Charles is going to be king and the Queen's protection is going to end. I don't know when, maybe sometime in 2050, I suppose she'll go that long, but nothing would surprise me. So I don't know what's going to happen with Andrew. Maybe it matters, maybe it doesn't. The important thing is that Ghislaine goes to prison. I think that would be a really great thing for justice, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's justice for these girls. But again, I think, you know, it would be great if they pressed her to explain what they were doing and why. And I don't know if that's ever going to come out. You know, it's an influence operation. I mean, they were aiming at certain types of people. And the Andrew connection, one of my sources told me that Epstein at one point bragged that Andrew's role was as a UK trade representative. That was his job. Right. If he can be said to have a job. Mm-hmm. And because of that job, if he was on Epstein's plane could land at any potentate's backyard in Africa or, you know, and he would be in the back room while they were having these diplomatic meetings. He could be in the back room arranging for, you know, dictatorial loot to be cached away. He bragged about this. And I think. I mean, this source, you know, maybe embellished a little bit, but it is true that if you have Andrew on your private jet or you have Bill Clinton on your private jet, you can land in a lot of places that people can't usually put their planes. For example, when Bill Clinton was on his jet, he was landing in, military bases in Japan, his private jet.
Mm.
So those connections are... you know, he was using them, or somebody was using them for something. And I don't think those questions are going to be answered in the trial.
Yeah. This is the sort of thing that's going to take years to unravel. If it ever gets unraveled. Okay. So the documentary is called Epstein's Ghost, right? Do I have it right?
Yeah, Epstein's Ghost, Ghislaine Maxwell. Oh, Epstein's Shadow. Sorry.
Epstein's Shadow. Okay.
It's Epstein's Shadow.
Wait, I'm going to say it again.
In one country.
So the documentary is called Epstein's Shadow, Ghislaine Maxwell.
You know what? It has two names. It's okay. Called Epstein's Ghost in one country and Epstein's Shadow in this country. I mean, in one country. So let me just, Epstein's Shadow, Ghislaine Maxwell.
Okay, that's the one that's on Peacock, and then the article about the article about
Epstein's Shadow, Ghislaine Maxwell.
Okay, so it's Epstein's Shadow, Ghislaine Maxwell. That's a documentary. It's on Peacock here in the United States. It's on Sky News in the UK. Anybody listening to this in Europe, I don't know, maybe use a VPN to get to one of those places to watch this thing. The article is called Sons of Anarchy.
You're global. You are global and you are bad.
There are people that watch this. There are people that listen to this in the UK, certainly, in Ireland, in Sweden, in Greece. I don't know. You know? Hi, guys.
You're international.
I know. I'm an international man of mystery.
It's amazing.
The article is called Sons of Anarchy. It's in Airmail Weekly. It really is a must read because I think you do kind of concisely explain what happened, and it is horrifying. And again, this is an isolated thing. This is something that easily could have been much worse. Yeah. And I think we keep saying that, hey, the insurrection was also easily could have been much worse, as horrible as it was. You know, we don't want this stuff to keep escalating. We want to nip it in the bud. We want the tide to turn and the trend to go in the other direction. So Nina, where can we find you?
www.ninaburley.com, my website. And I have books. I have written a number of books, and the most recent one is called Virus. I'm updating it for paperback, and I'm updating it with new, you know, the new developments related to these misinformation campaigns that have been monetized, like the frontline doctors and Jerome Corsi's involvement in, you know, in it. I don't know if you're familiar with all of this stuff, but it's maybe another show. It's fascinating. And I've been talking to the select subcommittee on coronavirus, and that's James Clyburn's committee. And I've had a lot of interaction with them, and I think they're doing great work, and we should pay more attention to the work they're doing, because look, 747,000 Americans and counting died. And the chief doctor of the Trump administration, Deborah Birx, is on the record now saying after 100,000, we didn't have to lose people. It absolutely has to do with this deliberate, not accidental chaos, deliberate vulture capitalism ideology, anti-government ideology, anti-expertise, and the inability for the very, very, the experts in the US, very, very prepared, pandemic preparedness organizations, networks, the inability of these people to pick up the phone and know who to talk to at the White House, because they didn't have scientists at the White House who would get up next to this president who was, all he cared about was getting reelected and making sure the numbers stayed low. Having a scientist up there telling the American people in those early crucial months, here's what's going on and here's what you got to do, you know, and they didn't have that. A pro-science administration like the one we have now would have handled it much differently. And there needs to be accountability. There needs to be accountability for the profiteering, the steering of contracts, the meddling in scientific data, the muzzling of scientists. This is all coming out of the select subcommittee's interviews with people. You know, they're about to talk to Redfield again, but a lot of us want to forget. We want to turn away from this because it wasn't very much fun, but we have to remember what happened, because these people, if they got back into power, would do exactly the same thing in terms of science and expertise and, you know, mustering the power of the U.S. government to protect American people, as opposed to using your power to show how private industry can do a better job when in fact it couldn't. Now, they did produce the vaccines, and that was a good thing. But the problem is the vaccines are great, but now you've got the very people who were the supporters of the very people who were behind putting the money up for it saying, don't take it, might mess your DNA up. You know, there might be a chip. That's the Republican Party line, Greg, because they need the numbers high. Now they need the numbers high.
It's
strategic, and it's absolutely malicious.
The whole thing is awful. And we've talked about this before, and I've talked about this many times. Trump and Mike Pence was the head of the White House coronavirus, the task force. He was in charge of it nominally. I don't know what he actually did, but he was in charge of it. And Jared Kushner, my God, that guy has blood on his hands. And if those three in particular are not called to account and pay for this, we're just lost as a country. If we can agree on one thing, it's that the people who brought the pandemic here and killed all of us, maybe we should, you know, maybe they should face some consequences. And if they don't, I don't even know what to say anymore if they don't. But, you know,
but I don't,
maybe
but
there's
I
a memo floating around the DOJ that Merrick Garland can read about it and it'll inspire him to get off his ass.
Yeah.
And maybe we can have like a special counsel.
You know, Glenn Kirshner this week, looking at the same stuff that I've been writing about from the subcommittee, new material came out about the muzzling of the scientists at the CDC. And he's got this YouTube talk up, which he lays out the reasons why he thinks the DC prosecutor can bring charges of involuntary manslaughter against Donald Trump. I talked to lawyers who are close to this, these investigations, and they're like, that's a nice idea, but you know, it's no dice. There isn't going to be that kind of accountability. It's ridiculous.
People profited off this shit, and there's no way if someone was profiting, Kushner and Trump profited. There is no reality in which some people profited and those two motherfuckers did not. So
no, they certainly did profit. Their friends profited. Mm-hmm. Their friends profited.
Yeah, it's disgusting. I sound like Trump. It's disgusting. It's a disgrace. But it is. It's a disgrace. It's disgusting. But one day, Nina, we should have a podcast where we just talk about literature and novels and movies. And
I'd
stuff.
Love so
we
that.
We don't have to talk about all these horrible, horrible people that we always wind up talking
that.
About.
Let's just do an English major fireside chat this winter. And we can read our favorite poems and discuss them and have people call in and read theirs.
I think that's a great idea. I think we'll do that for next time.
You're the man to do it.
I'm excited. This is a good idea. Because we want to end it somewhat uplifting. Nina Burley.
Make English majors listened to again.
Make English majors listened to again. Blah, 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 blah. We can come up with something better. We're English majors, damn it. Nina Burley, thanks so much for taking the time. Great to talk to you as always.
Yes, likewise. Take care. Thanks, Greg.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sophia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signet Della, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.